Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.
Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, a new list forecasts which of the region's critical infrastructure assets could soon be underwater at least twice a year. We examine which schools, hospitals, and fire stations are on that list and how the city is bracing for that impact. Later in the program, how to move forward after taking them down. Art scholar and activist Dr. Andrea Douglas brings the lessons of Charlottesville to Jacksonville. But first, they're the kind of structures we can't live without: hospitals, power plants, sewage treatment facilities. But those are the very spots on a list released this morning of critical infrastructure that is predicted to flood at least twice a year by the year 2050. To discuss this new report, we'll be joined by Dr. Juan Declet Barreto, senior scientist for the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, which produced the study. And I'm also joined by Ann Colonisi, Chief Resilience Officer with the City of Jacksonville. Welcome, Ann.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you back. So I think a good place to start with this list is it came out this morning. It's fairly extensive, and it lists a lot of projects in Jacksonville and on the First Coast that would be pretty concerning if they were immobilized or flooded out or, you know, inaccessible. What about this list that you've seen comes as a surprise?
Well, I think with most reports that come out, there's a little bit of good news and bad news. It's hard to imagine a report about sea level rise and some of our most critical facilities being at risk to have any good news attached to it. But if there is a silver lining, it's that there's nothing in this report that the city doesn't already know. And in fact, there's nothing in this report that hasn't been communicated in more detail to the public through our vulnerability assessment and through our resilience strategy. We did an extensive vulnerability assessment in the lead up to the resilience strategy, looking at a whole host of assets, the same list that this report looks at, from hospitals to schools to utility infrastructure to our roadway networks. We also looked at residential properties. And I think what we were able to do is look at both sea level rise and also our inland flooding from riverine events, and some preliminary information on where rainfall-induced flooding and our tributaries can add to it. So, in fact, our vulnerability assessment gets at flood hazards beyond what this study looks at. We also looked at all of those same assets for their risk from extreme wind events, wildfire, and we looked at the city spatially from a public health perspective from heat. So, you know, the good news, if there is any, is that we are really on top of tracking these assets and really understanding what on a whole host of threats could affect them. And so I think that's a positive here, is that we really do have a good grasp of our risks.
I think we're joined now on the line by Dr. Juan Declet Barreto. Good morning, doctor. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. Hello to you, Anne.
So I want to start this report that came out this morning. It lists a significant amount of critical infrastructure that's at risk today and in the near future, potentially affecting millions of coastal residents. You list all of these critical infrastructures that are subject to flooding on a biannual basis, right? Biannual? Twice a year, I should say.
Twice a year, yeah.
Yeah. Tell us why you wanted to issue a list of specific sites.
Well, we wanted to be able to provide information that would be useful, as Anne has just mentioned, to policymakers, to the public. I think it's pretty heartening to hear that the city of Jacksonville doesn't find a whole lot of surprising things in this report, which speaks a lot about the level of preparation that the city is engaging in and communicating to the public and communicating to their own policymakers what these risks are. So we thought that being able to harness different sets of critical infrastructure, a representative set of critical infrastructure, I should say, and provide detailed information about where those pieces of infrastructure across these six different categories that we looked at would be useful to communicate these risks nationally, different geographies, and also in a very local way.
And for who, I mean, define what critical infrastructure is.
Well, so how we defined it was services and infrastructure that people need to go about their daily lives. For example, energy infrastructure, power plants, and electrical substations. also educational institutions of all levels throughout the K-12 system, public safety or health facilities, such as fire stations, police stations, so on, water waste treatment plants, that are pieces of infrastructure that people rely on to live their daily lives, to live the good life. But we also thought of other pieces of infrastructure that could be, that if they were flooded, they would significantly also disrupt in very different ways people's lives. So we thought also of Superfund sites, toxic waste inventory sites, and also brownfield sites, which are EPA designation, Environmental Protection Agency designation, for places that host, that site, that process dangerous substances, in many instances, toxic. So when we think of the disruption to people's lives that could occur, if, for example, your children's school were to be flooded twice a year and children couldn't go to school or the school had to be relocated, or if a wastewater treatment plant that services hundreds of thousands or sometimes millions of people were to be knocked out of service because it's flooding at least twice a year, or the same thing with a power plant, that would be incredibly disruptive to people's lives.
I want to run through some of the specifics that this report lists. Forgive me a moment while I do that. But among the sewage treatment plants that are listed, there's two in Atlantic Beach, the city and the Buccaneer plant, one in Orange Park, one in Beacon Hills, San Pablo at the Players Club, Cypress Landing. Schools include Duncan Fletcher, Atlantic Beach Elementary, Finnegan Elementary, Mayport Middle, Beaches Chapel, Landrum, Ocean Palms, Stockton, and Venetia Elementary Schools. Safety facilities include Atlantic Beach Police Department, Atlantic Beach City Hall, 8 JFRD fire stations, and a couple in St. John's. Mayport as a whole, NAS as a whole, the Naval Fuel Depot, a couple of fire stations on Mayport, Life Flight at Baptist Medical on Prudential Drive, St. Vincent Riverside Hospital, the Port, Northside Generating Station, and then several Superfund sites. So we're going to have all of these projects listed on our website and on Jacksonville Today website later today. But Ann Colonisi, you say that the city has looked at this list, is aware of these risks. Tell us a little bit about how the city is looking holistically at trying to tackle those, and then whether there's like individual plans for each of those.
So I will say all of the sites you mentioned did come back in our vulnerability assessment. But we actually had more assets that lit up because we looked at a broader array of flood consequences. This report looks primarily at sea level rise and coastal flooding. We looked at inland riverine flooding as well, and really an initial look at the interplay between our coastal system and our inland riverine system.
And just to pause you there before you go on, riverine flooding, explain what that is. There's a lot of tributaries and rivers in this area.
I would love to. This is the topic I get very excited about. Within Jacksonville, there's 5 types of flooding. There's 2 coastal. One is sea level rise. The other is storm surge. So when we have a heavy wind event or hurricane, storm surge, but we also get that sea level rise tidal flooding on a routine basis. On the rainfall side of things, there's 2 types. Riverine, which is when we have heavy rainfall events that fall into our creek and tributary basins and cause those bodies of water to rise and overflow their banks and cause flooding. We also get that rainfall flooding in the form of stormwater, where that rain starts to collect on streets and sidewalks and can make it into homes and other facilities. And then really the 5th category is the most important for Jacksonville, and that's called compound flooding. And that's when 2 or more of these types of flooding happen at the same time. And it's one of the trickiest to model. And it's one of the places where Jacksonville is really putting itself in the driver's seat and being a pioneer city in terms of understanding our risk from compound flooding. We're currently working with a team of experts to develop a compound flood model for Jacksonville, and that model would evaluate 10,000 different scenarios of combinations of flooding. And I think one of the things that I really appreciated from this report that's out from the Union of Concerned Scientists is that it starts to really shift the conversation into talking about frequency. How often are things going to flood, and making decisions based on a probability of risk and a likelihood of flooding. And that's what our compound flood model will allow us to do. We can move away from this concept of flooding and our understanding of flood data being a binary. You're either in the floodplain or you're out of the floodplain. And instead, we can start talking about each parcel and each asset, whether it's the ones on this list or our broader list of assets, and really understanding the probability of every single hospital or school or utility piece of utility infrastructure, the probability of that being impacted by flooding, and the frequency that we can expect. And I think that's going to be what we use as our primary information for driving capital decisions, because as great as this report is, it's missing things because we have 59 major tributaries off of the St. John's River. And if you discount the interplay between our riverine system and the coast, you miss a lot of assets that we need to make sure are protected.
And yet frequency and intensity is something that is becoming harder and harder to gauge. I mean, we know it's from happening in South Florida just last week. They're seeing epic and really biblical flooding. I mean, they have had 20 inches in 24 hours. In the Midwest right now, we're seeing dams, you know, break, and some towns look like, you know, how New Orleans looked after Katrina. But we're seeing, like in Miami, a once in 200 year event that's the fourth in as many years. So how can even a model that's looking at all of these components and likelihoods account for the fact that even science doesn't know how difficult things are going to get as the climate warms?
I think the way that we do that is by running as many scenarios as possible. And I mentioned earlier that we've asked for an initial run of 10,000 scenarios. That's going to allow us to toggle all of the different factors that could contribute to flooding, whether that's soil saturation, because we know it matters if it's already rained all week before we get a major rainstorm. There's no place for that water to go. We're going to see more stormwater flooding. We also just instinctually understand compound flood flooding. It matters if a hurricane is hitting at high tide or low tide. And it matters if it rained for a week in Central Florida and the St. John's River is already at a very high watermark before we get a king tide or before a heavy wind event comes in. And so I think what's going to be really exciting about having this model and being able to use it in our capital planning decisions is giving the public more confidence that we understand these complexities. It's very hard to say we've looked at one factor, sea level rise, and you should feel really confident in our findings, because people understand that water is very dynamic and there's so many things that can impact it.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the critical infrastructure sites that have been marked as at risk of annual flooding within the next few decades. You can join our conversation live on the air by calling 904-549-2937. You can also email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can reach out on social media. I want to take a couple of calls now. We've got Charles on the west side. Good morning, Charles. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, I was wondering, you know, when Hurricane Harvey struck Houston, I understand there were some Superfund sites and holding ponds full of chemicals and whatnot that were spread all over the city because of the, you know, inundation. Do we have similar areas here in Jacksonville that we, like you mentioned brownfields earlier, do we have any similar sites here in Jacksonville that we need to be concerned about that, you know, should they be flooded? We're going to have all these hazardous chemicals all over the place.
It's a good question, Eric. The report cites at least four: the Kerr-McGee site, the Pickettville Road landfill, Brown's Dump, and then the various ash sites around the city where toxic ash was dumped from incinerators. Dr. DeClet-Barreto, what do we know about what protections, if any, are in place for Superfund sites when it comes to flooding or exposure to sea level rise?
Well, there's a Superfund sites and brownfields and toxic inventory sites, right? And those are three separate kinds of industrial contamination sites with different regulations and protections for mitigation of the exposure. I can tell you that in the case of Hurricane Harvey, as the caller said, the amount of rain that was dumped on top of some of those fuel depots and other large containers of toxic and dangerous substances, some of the roofs collapsed, and that was a sort of very acute kind of exposure to those contaminants. So yes, there is cause for concern, not just from sea level rise, obviously, but from all the other compound effects of flooding and storms and storm surge that Anne was talking about. Under emergency situations, the local Department of Environmental Quality or the State Department of Environmental Quality wherever that authority for regulation occurs, works typically with the regulated industries to shut down some pieces of equipment for those that are active. But sometimes when those facilities, some of these facilities are already shut down, haven't operated, but still house some of the toxic substances. So unless there is a very decided plan and effort to remediate the site, to get those toxics out of there, then it's actually anybody's guess as to what could happen in terms of the exposure that people could be subjected to. But it should be assumed that it will be significant.
And about that, I mean, when sites are controlled either by the state or by federal Superfund officials, the city probably doesn't have a great deal of input or role in protecting or mitigating for flood.
We're a player at the table, but you're right. There are kind of higher levels of government that are really coming in and playing the key regulatory role in making sure those sites are cleaned up. We do really monitor the ash sites, and specifically when we're thinking about new park spaces, you know, we're actively seeking out funding and keeping an eye out for opportunities to move forward with some of those cleanup areas. I also will flag that the Environmental Protection Board is currently working with the University of Florida on a septic tank vulnerability assessment. And part of that is also looking at the interplay of when we have flood conditions and where we could see failing septic tanks leaking more loads into our water bodies and causing our water bodies to become even further impaired. And so the interplay between flooding and water quality is something we're keeping our eye on, and we're really factoring into where and how we do upgrades to different infrastructure features across the city.
We have a call from John in St. Augustine. Good morning, John. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I've been living in Jacksonville since 1979, and I've seen the thunderstorms and the hurricanes and the water surge on the beach and in town. And I was looking to see if there is a map that shows the elevations in Northeast Florida, which would help identify the areas that are more susceptible for standing water and flooding.
And
absolutely. Absolutely. We have that, you know, the city's GIS has a layer on elevation, and there are obviously many federal resources like the U.S. Geological Survey where you can get elevation data. I will say there's more to flood risk than just elevation. And I think for our vulnerability assessment, we really factored in the sensitivity of assets, recognizing that a hospital carries more weight if flooded than a park. And we obviously care about our parks in the same way that we care about our hospitals. But to just look at one factor, you can often miss the complexity. And so we really, for our methodology, tried to combine both the elevation, the floodplain extent, and then the sensitivity of the assets that we were evaluating.
And so I want to circle back, because we did mention earlier, you know, what the city is doing in terms of like communicating with or planning with these specific sites for this eventuality. And so when it comes to something like a hospital, how are you helping, for instance, the Life Flight Center or the St. Vincent Hospital deal with this expected flooding?
So we've shared, we're in the process of sharing and have in the past shared the best available science and data that we have. My office is very committed to creating a culture of leaning on data heavily to make better informed capital decisions. The compound flood model that I mentioned earlier is going to be fully open data. And so that should be something that engineering firms in town are looking to as a resource when they are partnering with our hospitals or JEA or other independent authorities as they're making capital upgrades. And certainly my office will play a coordination role in making sure people know that resource is there so that we can all start to make these decisions off of data, because what we're seeing in the future looks very different from what we've seen in the past. And so relying on historic data doesn't tell us as much as looking at these forward-looking projections.
You know, the report go ahead, Doctor.
I just wanted to say real quick to get back to the caller's question that the elevation data does exist, and that's what we used in our model. Think of it,
It's what we call a bathtub model. Think of it as a bathtub that can hold only so much water. And any water that you dumped in it, inside of it, that goes beyond the rim of the bathtub, then spills over. That's what gets flooded in our model. Again, completely agreeing with Anne that we're only considering sea level rise, and there are many other sources and in a dynamic interplay that will create flooding.
And so this is not a complete list, as the report notes. I mean, there's a lot of things that are not included: transportation infrastructure, drinking water facilities, retirement homes. And is that the kind of thing that is included in the city's analysis?
It is. We looked at residential properties. We looked at nursing homes, affordable housing. So really multifamily housing. We really tried to make sure that we understood the assets where people live as much as the services that they rely on. And I'm really proud of the transportation analysis that we did. We looked at all roadways in Jacksonville and the vulnerability of those roadways to flood, but we also looked at the cascading roadway networks that would then be cut off from the rest of the city. I think this report does a great job of highlighting how flooding could impact, assets that we rely on. If your child's school floods, that's a disruption for your family. But if the road that you need to take to get to work or to drop your kid off at school has flooded, even if your home is dry, your life has been disrupted. And so this road network analysis we did helped us understand where we could see residents cut off and cut off more frequently from flooding. And that's also guiding our capital investments in upgrading and elevating different bridges and roadways around the city. This is also data that has been shared with our emergency preparedness division. And I've been told that they've reviewed it and updated this year's evacuation zones based on that data. We didn't want someone to accidentally be in a lower priority evacuation zone when they're an outlier within their neighborhood and they have a really unique roadway that's going to flood. We want to make sure that that's captured and that they know that they are likely going to need to leave their neighborhood slightly earlier. So we're in hurricane season now, people. Know your zone. Look it up. You can find all of the resources you need to make sure your family is ready for hurricane season at jacksready.com. And I would encourage every resident to make a plan for hurricane season and just know that this is something where we're taking the best data we have and the best analysis and making sure that on an annual basis, we're giving you the best information. So it's always important to double check your zone.
And that vulnerability assessment that you did with the Resilience Office found 18,000 miles of roads would be inaccessible during these compound flooding scenarios. That's 28% of major roads and 22% of minor roads. So that's obviously not a small impact. And that is far beyond, I think, what most people, as you allude to, think of as kind of like their zone or the floodplain.
Yeah. And I will say that this is an area, again, where we're hoping to be at the forefront of really calibrated understandings of how flooding can impact roadways. With our compound flood model, the city will be developing a real-time forecasting system that emergency managers can use during an active storm event that would pull National Weather Service data in advance of a hurricane and input it into a fast-running version of our model and crank out a map in real time. And particularly, we're interested in using this as a tool to help us understand not just which roads might flood during an active disaster, but how deep and for how long, so that we know when will passenger vehicles be suddenly impassable in this. How long can we get a JFRD rig and out? And at what points during a storm event might this road be completely inaccessible from a vehicle's perspective?
We have a comment on Facebook, which is a little to the side, but I think worth addressing. So Susan Thatcher said, the city is responding to this impending threat by spending multi-millions on a football stadium. Obviously, that's not quite in your wheelhouse, but at the same time, you for a long time were running this office as a single employee tackling resilience for the city of Jacksonville. Is it a fair criticism to say, you know, why is the city spending on this or that other priority when this is such a consequential and existential threat?
Well, I will say that, you know, I've been a team of one, but one of the things that's allowed this office to stand up so well and so quickly, we're in the third year now, is capital improvement plan funding that's been dedicated for resilience. So there's been, the first 5 years of the program were slated for $10 million each year. And so we're now in year three. I've been able to use some of those early allocations of funding to produce this vulnerability assessment, our resilience strategy. We're also moving forward right now on bringing on a qualified team to help the city with developing an urban forestry management plan. That's currently on the street where we're accepting bids, so I can't talk about it too much, but bring me back once that solicitation silence period is over, and it's a project I'm very excited to talk about. We're also moving in this summer now that I do have staff capacity in our office, with spending down that money on some preliminary projects that can help us make sure other projects in the CIP are incorporating resilience. So we're looking at setting up a pilot phase of a green infrastructure program, looking at where within our right-of-way and our public parks we can add infrastructure features that absorb flooding and mitigate extreme heat. And the goal with this pilot phase would to be to standardize designs that can be essentially copy and pasted in multiple parts of our city to really beef up the amount of storage capacity and heat mitigation that we have. So I think that seed funding has been really critical. And it's also allowed me to go after federal grants and state grants because we know we have a match in house, and it buys us time to also figure out, are there other parts of the city that are a more appropriate fit for that match long term? But I never have to not go after a grant because I'm worried about where the match would come from. So that CIP funding has been very dynamic for the office, and it's allowed us, even in absence of full-time positions, which we do now have, to really get this all of this work started.
How close are we as a city to compelling adherence to what you know and what we now know about predicted flooding? And I mean insofar as saying, you can't develop on this land. We know that in 2050, it's likely to flood out twice a year.
We are actively working with an advisory committee made up of developers and engineers and affordable housing advocates, environmental advocates, community members, to revisit the city's land development regulations from a resilience perspective and really starting to talk about our city as having high-risk areas for flooding and also having areas that are of low flood risk, and looking at a new model for how we can write regulations that make it attractive for development to take place in our low risk areas, really driving infill and density in areas of our city that we know can accommodate that. And then on the flip side, really revisiting the areas that are high flood risk and what additional regulatory measures we might need in place to make sure that we're not putting dense affordable housing development in an area that either today or in the future will be high risk for flooding. And so this is a really exciting conversation. We have great advocates on this committee and a strong support of a consultant team helping us write that. So a lot of that will be taking place over the summer. And in the fall, I'm hoping we'll have things that we can talk about publicly as findings from that body of work.
Dr. DeClet-Barreto, I want to ask you about cost, since we're touching on that. Jacksonville has over 1,000 miles of coastline. Florida has, 8,500 miles of coastline. Our colleague Noah Hertz at Jacksonville Today recently reported on a project in Volano Beach where they're looking at building a mile wall, roughly a seawall, for $100 million. You can do the math on that. And we're talking, well over $1 trillion that it would cost to try to harden some of those shorelines. You've proposed in this report a kind of tax on agencies or companies that contribute to global warming. Explain how that would work.
Well, let's see. So what we try to do with that is to make sure that we place accountability where it goes. This sea level rise increase that is threatening and will continue to threaten infrastructure and people's lives has one culprit, and that is fossil fuels that are causing climate change and the climate crisis. And that is largely driven by the fossil fuel industry's continued extraction and burning of fossil fuels. So as part of our accountability work and accountability efforts that are going on in many levels of government in the United States and globally, we are trying to make sure that the entities responsible for that climate change pay the fair share to reduce this impact. So, regardless of where the funds come from to pay for this, this is an impact that needs to be addressed. We try to stay away from the specifics of how much things would cost, because there is no one-size-fits-all answer
to be able to eyeball or to estimate how much it would cost to harden an electrical substation or power plant or a wastewater treatment plant. There are many, many different factors that are going to vary regionally across different government, different administrative areas and different places and different characteristics of the coastline. But we know that those are very, very disruptive and very costly events.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Dr. Juan Declet Barreto, Ann Colonese, thank you so much for coming on the program today and talking about this.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Up next, an activist and educator brings the lessons of Charlottesville to Jacksonville. Welcome back. July 10th, nearly 3 years ago, the statue of Robert E. Lee on horseback rode out of downtown Charlottesville Park on the back of a flatbed. The removal was a victory for those who've been fighting to get rid of the Confederate tribute, but it came at a great cost. Here to talk about that effort and the path since then is Dr. Andrea Douglas. She's the executive director of Jefferson School Heritage Center. Good morning, Dr. Douglas.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for being here. We're also joined here in studio by Wells Todd, organizer with Take 'Em Down Jacks, which is hosting Dr. Douglas's upcoming appearance in Jacksonville. Hi, Wells.
Hi, good morning, Ann.
Good morning. Dr. Douglas, your organization was charged with melting down the statue of Lee to create a different piece of public art. As an art historian yourself, were you at all conflicted by that process?
Absolutely not. And in fact, just to be clear, I am the executive director of an organization called the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center. And I think that is one of the, and I only make that clarification as a way of answering your question. So we aren't necessarily, we weren't charged with it. We actually proposed it. After a sort of extracted court battle, it became possible in the state of Virginia as a consequence of a Supreme Court ruling for localities to make decisions about what could happen with their objects in public places. And so we actually made a request for the object through proposal as part of that process that was developed in order to obtain a statute. Or you had to make a request. There had to be 60 days of public hearing prior to that capacity for Charlottesville City Council to make the vote. So that's kind of how we acquired the statue. On December 7th of 2020, the City Council voted for our proposal, and that's how we received it. So, and I say that also to answer your question, because in that there is an intentionality. Yes, I'm an art historian. And because I'm an art historian, I've been involved in thinking about, for most of my career, I'm a social historian, and thinking about public spaces and the objects that occupy those public spaces and how those objects articulate cultural and social value. And it's within that mindset that I have been thinking about these objects. And I've been doing that since 2016, when I was part of what Charlottesville's Blue Ribbon Commission on race monuments in public spaces. And so having an opportunity, certainly as the director of the Heritage Center, to understand this local narrative deeply and understanding when and how those statues were placed within the context of the work, as I do as an art historian, and understanding how these public objects can carry ideology. And it became clear to me as the executive director for the Heritage Center that as we look at where we live, at the moments these objects are placed, what they're the work that they're doing, how they're functioning in these public spaces, it was necessary post-2017 to think about them differently, and then that caused them to be removed from our city parks.
And so, for those who don't remember 2017 and what was happening in Charlottesville at that time, remind us of the environment there and what was going on.
Right. Well, you know, we call here in Charlottesville, 2017, August 2017, we call 2017 in that period the Summer of Hate. What happened in August 11th and 12th was the Unite the Right rally that led to mob violence and the death of three people and the injury of over 29, almost 30 people in our community. And a lot of, we can point directly to the desire to maintain the Lee statue in its place as some of the catalysts for that. There are several other reasons why this Unite the Right rally came to pass, but the symbol that was being used and where the melee ultimately occurred was right in the park where that Lee statue stood. And so for us in Charlottesville, that object is represents a site of trauma. And through a community engagement process that we began very quickly after the vote in 2017 to remove the statues from public space that happened, the Heritage Center and our partners began to do a series of education projects to cause people to understand.
I think we just lost you, Dr. Douglas, but I want to turn to Wells Todd. So why did Take 'Em Down Jacks want to hear from Dr. Douglas? You're bringing her to town as part of a Southern Poverty Law Center grant that the Take 'Em Down received. What questions do you have for her when she comes to town?
Well, we feel fortunate to be able to bring her to Jacksonville, and we want her to explain the process that her group went through to bring attention to the need to remove these statues. We feel that the struggle is not over. The event, and I'd like to kind of let everybody know when and where the event will take place. Will take place Friday, July 12th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Jesse, which is 40 East Adams Street. It's a free event, but we would like people to register on Eventbrite just so we know how many people are coming. The issue is being able to get our society to a point where they can actually own what these statues represent. And these statues are scattered throughout the South and as far west as Hawaii. There's recognition of the Confederacy and in the Northwest also. And so we understand that these statues don't really represent celebrating soldiers who died during the Civil War, but actually celebrate the false ideology of white supremacy. And so once again, we are proud to have Professor Douglas join us on Friday, July 12th at the Jesse to explain exactly the process that took place and why this fight needs to continue.
And Dr. Douglas, I think we have you back on the line. I know one of the things that you're going to address is, you know, a path forward for Jacksonville based on some lessons learned in Charlottesville. Tell us what you think worked and what didn't work in your eyes in terms of how that whole process went.
Well, I mean, I don't know if I can say what didn't work, because this has been a process that has for us and most places has never occurred before. You know, we receive the statue, and then within days of receiving the statue, we were named as part of a lawsuit, and that lawsuit went on for 2 years. The lawsuit was hoping to challenge the process that the city of Charlottesville undertook in order to award us the statue. It was two organizations that tried to make that happen, Trevilian Station and Radcliffe Foundation, that both of those organizations were found to not have actual standing in their application. And so we have had maybe a series of fits and starts, but these fits and starts have allowed us to do other things that continue the community engagement piece. So while we were held off from melting the statues down right away, what we did accomplish, or what was accomplished in those lawsuits, was the development of case law such that if any other community wants to take the steps that we have taken and they are then sued by that, there is now immediate case law that would support a Supreme Court ruling that it's possible for localities such as ours. And the thing that's important to know is that Virginia is a Dillon Rule state. And so the possibility of localities dealing with their public schools up until now had to have been discussed in the General Assembly. It was the General Assembly that gave that power. Now, in Virginia, the localities have the power themselves and can make the decisions about that. So, in real terms, as I start to think about what we've accomplished since receiving that statue, certainly being able now to carry out the plans that we described in our Swords and Plowshares application that was supported by 23 organizations in our community when we made that application. The act of melting down the statue was just a step along the way to what our larger goal is, which is to create this democratic process that is an antithesis to the process where those objects were originally placed.
Dr. Douglas, I'm just briefly going to ask Wells to catch us up on where and when they can come and see you.
Okay, Anne. Once again, the event is called Recasting the Past, from Confederate Monuments to Symbols of Peace, featuring Dr. Andrea Douglas, and it's Friday, July 12th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Jesse, and that's 40 East Adams Street. We'd like you to register. It is a free event, but we'd like you to register on Everbrite. Go to takeemdownjacks.com.
Wells, Todd, Andrea Douglas, thank you both so much for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ann.
Stick around. We'll be back in 4 beats with a weekend forecast of some hot salsa.
LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you. WinGuard is a marketing and communications agency dedicated to helping businesses and nonprofits cut through the digital noise, creating digital marketing to leave an impression with services to meet audiences where they are, online. More at wearewinguard.com.
On the next Fresh Air, the director of the 2023 adaptation of The Color Purple, the musical, Blitz Bazawule, joins us to talk about his work as a director, painter, rapper, and novelist. He has a new exhibit of paintings about his formative years growing up in Ghana. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
The U.S. Supreme Court is nearing the end of a very consequential term. Presidential immunity, abortion, guns, the environment, it's all there.
They have a pretty small docket, all things being relative. They're not going to wind up issuing that many decisions. But there are a lot of, like, really historic cases.
I'm Deborah Becker. The impact of this year's Supreme Court decisions. That's on the next On Point.
Today at 11 on WJCT News 89.9.
They say the past is never dead. It's not even really past. Where we are now as a country is all about where we've been. Next time on 1A, we speak to the journalist and historian Nick Bryant. His new book, The Forever War, America's Unending Conflict with Itself, maps a path from the founding of America to the politics of today.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. Well, it's time for a little salsa. Not the kind you eat, but the kind that gets you moving. And here to tell us about it is Liz McCoy, the executive director of James Weldon Johnson Park. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you so much.
Welcome
for
back.
Happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't go wrong with either kind of salsa in my mind.
Absolutely not. You know, it's hot. It's going to be hot out on Saturday, but so is salsa. Salsa's hot in every step of the word.
Totally.
You know?
And so this is the 904 Salsa Fest. It's at James Weldon Johnson Park. And there's a lot that's going to be on offer there. But I want to ask you, because we were just talking about the issue of Confederate monuments, having a big conversation. This park used to have a Confederate monument. This park used to have a different name. Tell us a little bit about the transformation that has happened there since.
Well, I think the biggest part is that it is a truly a public space, as your former guest was talking about. It's a public space that is welcoming to all. And we want to make sure that we celebrate all cultures and make sure that everybody's comfortable within the park. And that's one of the reasons why we are doing 904 Salsa Fest, because, of course, you know, our culture is changing. The demographics of Jacksonville are changing, and we want to make sure that everybody's represented and give people a little bit of taste. You know, all of our events are free to attend. They're family friendly. And so you can come down to James Weldon Johnson Park and see lots of different things and see yourself. And that's the biggest biggest change, which we appreciate.
And when you talk about making it welcome and comfortable, I think it's interesting you said that in the heat of the day, now you have an offering for people to kind of cool them down.
We do. We have what's called the Mister, and it is a tent that actually has some misting water. So if you are too hot and you find yourself out and about in downtown Jacksonville, which is a concrete jungle, we've got some trees, we've got some shade, and we also have the Mister tent, and you can walk through it, and it is it gets you a little bit wet, but not soaking, so it's just a little bit of a relief from the heat.
And will that be cranking during the Salsa Fest?
Absolutely.
So this is an evening event. It's from 5 to 9. Tell us about, like, how the park is trying to position itself with a little bit more of nighttime activity and to kind of activate that space in the evenings.
Well, you know, a lot of people are saying that there's nothing to do in Jacksonville, which, of course, I don't agree with. But, you know, downtown Jacksonville does need some activation. And so that is our biggest charge, is to make sure that, you know, downtown is activated. We are a space that is available for people to come to. People can rent out the space if need be. And we also helped with our own events that we do, and just give somebody, you know, a thing to do on a weekend that, once again, is free.
So salsa is like a couple's dance. What if I don't have a partner to go with? Do I have to have somebody to go with to this event?
Not at all. In fact, one of the things that I love about salsa and the salsa community, especially here in Jacksonville, is that they're so generous with their time and their knowledge. And there's also going to be three different dance classes, salsa dance classes by Malembe Dance Company. And that's going to be at 5:30, 6:30, and 7:30. So you can come to one of those classes, learn about it, and then, you know, maybe see a partner that, you know, people always shift partners, you know, so it's see somebody that you like their style of dancing, and then just ask them to dance. It's absolutely great. So
food trucks. What else is going to be cooking that night?
There'll be DJ XL, DJ Nandi, and a very special performance. Ritmo y Sabor will be a salsa band that's performing, but there's a very special guest that's going to be performing with the band.
Oh, let's hear it.
Yaya.
Our favorite.
Our favorite. Yeah. Yaya is going to be performing with that band for the first time in 5 years.
That's excellent. And we should say that she's the new and the first Hispanic outreach coordinator now for the city of Jacksonville.
That is correct. Yes. She is so passionate about celebrating the Latin culture that we have here in Jacksonville. And one of the hopes is to get this particular festival. Like, we're on the groundworks of it right now, but eventually we want to turn this into an entire big festival and convention so people don't have to go to Atlanta or Miami or New York. They can stay right here in Jacksonville and celebrate their culture.
She's also an incredible salsa dancer and a great instructor.
That's right. That's right. And there's some really wonderful instructors that are going to be out there. I've happened to take dance lessons from them as well, and they're really amazing.
So this is this coming weekend. Do people need to sign up or can they just show up?
They just show up. You don't even need to sign up. Just show up. If you'd like to know more and if you'd like to sign up on our Facebook account, it's 904 Salsa Fest on Facebook.
Awesome. Well, Liz McCoy from James Weldon Johnson Park, thanks so much for being here and telling us about it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. And that's our program. We encourage your feedback and suggestions. You can send either to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. If you missed anything, you can catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock, but you can also subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast platform. The executive producer of First Coast Connect is David Luckin. Our producer is Stacey Bennett. We hope she's feeling better. Jamie Vallée is our associate producer. Our director is Brady Corum. And Club de Belugas performs our theme song. Join us tomorrow when we examine the impact on arts and culture organizations after the governor vetoes all funding statewide. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided in part by Baptist Health.